Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
The marshal that's assigned will be invisible on the screen other than putting up the timer for the attorneys. Attorneys, are you going to be able to see the timer or would you rather that I tell you or remind you when you're at the 5-minute interval and when you're working down on your time clock? Mr. Petras, your preference?
If you would give me a 5-minute reminder, I would greatly appreciate that.
All right, and Ms. Sergis?
I cannot see the timer, so if you could give me a 5-minute reminder, I would appreciate that as well.
I will do that. However, our marshal, Miranda Johnson, will still put the timer up so that we can see it. The judges from our different respective places that we're doing this. Thank you, lawyers, for your patience. We're still working out some of the bugs. Right now, I'm speaking into my cell phone because I've totally lost audio with the WebEx meeting. However, otherwise, everything is a go. Each of you are aware of appellate rules of practice. 15 minutes for presentation of your case. Mr. Petras, as the appealing, as the appellate party, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that feature. When you're ready to go again for our recording purposes, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf. And unless anyone has any questions, we're ready when you are, Mr. Petras.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, I am a Special Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Adam Petras, and I am appearing on behalf of the appellant in this matter, the state of Minnesota. And there are two main points I would like to address this morning. And the first is to talk about how this court has already ruled on the issue that is presented in this case for previous decisions. And the second point I would like to bring up is to address respondents' argument that the McNeely was incorporated into the Birchfield rule. So getting to that first point, respondent attempts to distinguish this court's previous published decision in O'Connell by saying that O'Connell was limited to situations or cases in which an individual was prosecuted for driving while impaired, as opposed to the situation that happened to Mr. Johnson, which was he was prosecuted for refusing a chemical test. But that is not what this court wrote in O'Connell. In the syllabus point at the outset of that published decision, I'm gonna quote for you here, this court wrote, "The rule announced in Missouri v. McNeely that natural dissipation of alcohol in the blood does not constitute a per se exigency justifying a warrantless search does not retroactively apply on collateral review of a final conviction."
Mr. Petras, if I may.
Yes, Judge Jessen.
But wasn't McConnell before Johnson? And don't we really just have to look at the rationale? And I understand Johnson reserved in that footnote the McNeely issue, but look at the rationale in Johnson to see if really we have to reconsider the McConnell case.
I don't think so. I don't think that's how retroactively is determined. I think it's determined by looking at the function or the character of the rule that was announced, not necessarily the rationale of a subsequent decision. And if you look at that function and character of the rule in McNeely, it is procedural. I guess one argument, does that answer your question, Judge?
But when we're looking at whether McNeely is procedural, don't we have to do that analysis using kind of the same analysis that the Johnson court used in looking at the search incident to arrest exception? And if we apply that same rationale or analysis, wouldn't we find, I mean, I just read that in my first take, and I want your thoughts on this, is the Missouri versus McNeely would be retroactive as well.
No, I guess I disagree because what Birchfield did, which is what was being analyzed in Johnson, what Birchfield did was it said that the search incident to arrest exception to warrant requirement cannot justify a warrantless blood or a warrantless urine test. I guess that's both Birchfield and then Thompson, which was applying Birchfield. What McNeely said is that exigent circumstances can still justify a warrantless blood or warrantless urine test. It's just how the determination is made about whether a extenuating circumstance exists in a particular case. So continuing on or kind of driving home that point, I guess just because Birchfield used or relied or cited McNeely in its analysis and the Minnesota Supreme Court subsequently found Birchfield to be retroactive, that does not mean that every single rule or every single decision that Birchfield relied or cited is necessarily retroactive.
Well, could I ask you this? You know, I mean, I know that there's a million and one cases that discuss this substantive versus procedural rule, and we have to decide which one it is. And so I think, don't we have to look at the function of the rule? I mean, the function of McNeely. I mean, I'm looking at this, and one of the cases, I think it's Cherillo, said that if you have a rule that narrows the scope of a criminal statute by interpreting its terms, then that could be a substantive. I mean, isn't this definition of what exigent circumstances? I mean, the reason we need that here is to define what criminal act or whether this act is in fact criminal. So doesn't that make it substantive rather than procedural?
No, because I go to I understand that line in Chiro. I feel that goes more to the element did not change.
You're going to have to repeat what you're saying because you're not coming through.
Sorry.
Sit right there. Then we can hear you.
Chiro was referring to the elements of the offense as opposed to.
Okay, we're losing you again. You're coming through very well.
Okay. Shiro referred to the elements being narrowed as opposed to the way in which an element is determined. And that is a distinction that matters in retroactivity. Pointing to McNeely, it did not limit the categories or types of conduct that are prohibited by the test refusal statute. In fact, using a phrase that's also all over case law, impeccable fact finding could leave a pre-McNeely conviction in place because the totality of the circumstances could create exigency. For instance, the dissipation of alcohol may not be a single factor by itself, but it can still play a role in that exigency determination. And that, along with other factors, which McNeely recognizes, such as the availability of a magistrate to sign a warrant, the time that it would take to find one, that could still very well be valid before McNeely. McNeely did not eliminate that possibility. So a fact-finding adventure could validate a pre-McNeely conviction. And because that is a possibility, the rule that was announced in McNeely is not substantive, does not eliminate kind of all possibility of that conduct being criminal. Putting it a different way, what I see the case law, and you're right, Judge Hooten, that there are so many decisions, you know, that now try to define substantive versus try to define procedural. And what I took from the case law is that a procedural rule regulates the manner of determining, regulates the manner of determining somebody's guilt. And I think this is agreed to by respondent on page 18 of respondent's brief. He writes, the key question in retroactivity analysis is whether the new rule renders a person's conduct immune from punishment or whether it requires the state to prove guilt in a different way. And what respondent was quoting there is the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson. And I agree with that. As a result of McNeely, the elements of test refusal did not change. Rather, how one of those elements, the validity of an exception to the warrant requirement, that's the element, but how one of those elements is determined, that is the thing that has changed. I mean, McNeely simply requires the state to prove facts that are specific to a particular case. That is, in essence, proving guilt in a different way. And that is a new procedural rule.
Well, let me ask you this. Could it be both? I mean, could it be both a procedural and also a substantive rule? Because it is defining the essence of what it, you know, what this crime encompasses, what this statute is intended to make criminal. And I can see how you can argue that it might be procedural because the police have to show certain things to show that there's exigent circumstances when there's a stop like this. But doesn't it also get into the core definition of what conduct constitutes criminal conduct?
Mr. Petras, before you answer, you wanted me to alert you to the 5 minutes. You hit that milestone.
I appreciate that, Judge Werke. Thank you. Judge Hooten, to respond to your question, I think this is a close call. And I'll answer the question this way. I am not aware of any decision from any jurisdiction which has held that a rule is both procedural and substantive for retroactivity purposes. Retroactivity law, Teague, requires that it fall into one of those two camps in order to determine whether or not it goes back and can touch a final conviction. But what I will say is this court has answered that question before and has even answered it, going back to a question Judge Jessen asked earlier, has answered it after Johnson. I was talking about O'Connell earlier, and one case that I cite in my brief is Sebulka. And that one was not addressed at all in the respondent's brief. And I understand that Sebulka came before Birchfield and came before Johnson. But what's relevant about Sebulka is the exact identical claim that is being raised by respondent, or the argument that's being advanced by respondent in this case, that saying O'Connell only applies to driving, and thus McNeely is substantive in character with respect to a refusal act. And this court rejected that in Sebulka. So if the court were to agree with respondent in this particular case, it would have to expressly refute the syllabus point in O'Connell. It would have to expressly overrule Sebulka, which I understand is unpublished, but is directly on point.
All right, I was going to ask that. It does appear to be unpublished.
Yeah, and then Korsmo, which is another case I cited in my brief, that is also unpublished. That came out last January, 15 months ago, January, which was after Johnson. And it ultimately conducted kind of a totality of the circumstances exigency analysis, but again, unpublished. Earlier in that decision, it talks about the same principle that this court held in Sebulka, which is that McNeely is not retroactive to convictions that were final before McNeely was issued in 2013. I guess the last thing I would like to say, because I'm down to about 2 minutes, is a respondent uses term, and this kind of goes to your last question as well, Judge Hooten, retroactive as applied. And I don't believe that is a distinction that exists in Teague or anywhere in Minnesota's retroactivity jurisprudence. This is not a First Amendment challenge to a statute, which can lead to a court determining something to be either facially invalid or, you know, unconstitutional as applied to those particular facts. In retroactivity law, a rule is either retroactive or it's not. There is simply no such thing as retroactive as applied. That is consistent with United States Supreme Court precedent, like what the Judge Hooten was just citing, and that's also consistent with Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson's first appeal, in which it held that it was retroactive to everything, but still required a kind of a case-by-case determination, which is the whole reason we're here before you today. A new rule can't be retroactive as applied. New rule can either be completely retroactive or not retroactive. And I don't believe this court's previous decisions or case law would justify McNeely being retroactive to all cases. I am happy to entertain any other questions with my last 30 seconds. Otherwise, I will wait for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Petras. We'll turn then to Ms. Sergis.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Veronica Sergis with the Office of the Appellate Public Defender, currently with the Office of the Appellate Public Defender, and I represent Mark Jerome Johnson. The Supreme Court has already held that Birchfield, Trahan, Thompson announced a new substantive rule of law that must be applied retroactively as applied to certain individuals, regardless of when the conviction occurred. Following what I'll refer to as Johnson 1, the new question is whether the McNeely analysis applies when considering whether exigent circumstances justify a conviction. In the context of Birchfield and Johnson, McNeely narrowed the scope of the test refusal statute and created a class of people whose conduct is no longer criminal. McNeely is therefore retroactive when it comes to the Johnson analysis of exigent circumstances. At the outset here, the core question is to determine whether a rule is substantive or procedural, is whether, based on the facts alleged in the charging document, so in the complaint from 2010, if we look at that complaint from 2010 today, is the person innocent or is the person guilty? Here, based on that complaint, Johnson is innocent, so his conviction must be vacated and we must apply McNeely retroactively. This analysis is, as Judge Jessen noticed, largely identical to the Supreme Court's analysis in Johnson the First. The state claims that this issue has already been decided in O'Connell because the syllabus notes that the rule is procedural. O'Connell is inapposite for a few reasons. The first thing that I'll note at the outset is that O'Connell never addressed retroactivity in the briefs. The attorney in O'Connell argued that Mr. O'Connell's conviction was not final, and therefore they did not get into the weeds of retroactivity. The court did hold then on its own that McNeely was not retroactive after determining that O'Connell's conviction was in fact final. But it's important, just like it was important in the first Johnson, to clarify exactly what the crime at issue is. We are not talking about drunk driving here. We were talking about drunk driving in O'Connell, but here we are talking about the crime of asserting a constitutional right. The gentleman in O'Connell was in fact guilty of drunk driving, and I don't think we have a great argument that McNeely is substantive as applied to people convicted of DWI. Because in a DWI context, police and the state still have a chemical test. The question is, how did they get that chemical test? So then that's very much like Teague, where in that case, having black jurors did not change the fact that the defendant was in fact guilty. It just changed the manner of finding his guilt. Well, that's accurate for DWI.
Could you address the state's primary argument, which is that the requirement to get a warrant in the circumstances that would require the police to get a warrant, it's clearly procedural. That's the state's argument, as I understand it. And
absolutely.
And so how do you respond to that? If it's procedural, you'll agree that it wouldn't be retroactive, correct?
It's a rule that has procedural and substantive applications. And we have, there's plenty of case law confirming the fact that a rule can have both procedural and substantive applications. Most importantly,
counsel,
we have...
Council was saying there is no such case where it's either one or the other.
And I feel a little bit confused on that. I hope I'm not missing something huge, because that was Johnson. That was Johnson and all the cases relied upon in Johnson, where we say that the court said it's okay that a rule can be applied procedurally and substantively. That does not mean that for purposes of retroactivity, it's not retroactive. We see that in Montgomery. We see that in Welch. We see that, again, clearly in Johnson. And I certainly hope I'm not misinterpreting some of the language in Johnson, but that's the case law that we already have. That case law is fairly clear to me. And that actually, that brings me to another point about Sibulka. I did not address Sibulka in my brief because, frankly, I didn't see the need to. Sibulka is unpublished, and importantly, Sibulka has already largely been overruled. In Sibulka, the Court of Appeals said the Supreme Court has never held that a new rule is substantive. Well, now the Supreme Court has held that a new rule is substantive. They held that in Johnson. In Sibulka, the Court of Appeals said a rule can never be retroactive as applied. Again, that's been overruled by Johnson. Johnson specifically said that a rule can be retroactive as applied. And Johnson, I believe, relied specifically on Welch to determine that. But the Supreme Court was quite clear in Johnson that that a rule can be substantive as applied. So Sibulka is highly unpersuasive for those reasons, along with the fact that it is, in fact, unpublished. A case-by-case determination.
Can I ask you this? As a practical matter, what is the difference between the requirement for getting a warrant pre-McNeely and post-McNeely? How does it affect this case?
If I understand your question correctly, I mean, pre-McNeely, police didn't need a warrant. Pre-Birchfield, police didn't need a warrant. All they had to do was point to a warrant exception. Now, pre-McNeely, that warrant exception was simply the dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream. Nothing else. The analysis ends there. After McNeely, police need to have something more. Dissipation of alcohol can be a factor. We see that in, for example, Stavish, where there are helicopters and life flights and hospitals. The dissipation can be a factor, but it's no longer a single factor, and police need to have more. And then, of course, when Birchfield came along, that included the warrant requirement, which means that police then had to take all of these factors and go to a judge to get a warrant. Does that answer your question, Judge Hilton?
I think so, but my impression was that the district court did not think it made much of a difference in this case. Am I correct?
The district court didn't think it made much of a difference. I will be completely honest. I feel as though the district court analysis missed the mark just a little bit. I obviously agree with the ultimate conclusion the district court made, but I do think that it was important to consider whether or not McNeely was retroactive, because before McNeely, I mean, police didn't have to, they didn't have to prove, or I'm sorry, we didn't have to prove that they had access to a warrant, because police just, all they had to say was, well, dissipation of alcohol, that's enough, no warrant needed.
Who did the district court appropriately apply the burden of proof in dealing with this petition?
You broke up a little bit there. Were you asking about the burden of proof?
Did the district court apply the appropriate burden of proof?
No, the district court did not apply the appropriate burden of proof. I think that this court can make its own determination based on the facts presented. The Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court did so in Trahan. barring that, barring the court's decision to do that, a remand would reasonably be appropriate because no, the district court did not get that correct.
Okay, thank you. And so that's undisputed.
That's undisputed.
Could you say a little bit more about this? Because I was under the impression that if we agreed with your position on retroactivity, then we needed to remand. And I was trying to think about what those remand instructions looked like so the district court could, under this totality of the circumstances approach, you know, examine the exigency of the circumstances. You said you didn't think, I mean, for us to do that, it just seems like a stretch. So tell me more about why you think this court should be doing that.
Question correctly, it was, isn't it a bit of a stretch for the Court of Appeals to make the determination on exigent circumstances? I don't think it's a bit of a stretch because there is some ability, there's some history of the court doing that again in Trahan. That's what happened. With that said, I would certainly understand if the court did remand back to the district court for a finding on exigency.
Ms. Surges, you're at 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to summarize here because I think we hit on all of my most important points. In the context of test refusal, McNeely is retroactive. To hold otherwise would effectively narrow Johnson, the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson, to saying that the Birchfield decision and the Birchfield decision, the part of it that declared test refusal unconstitutional, that actually is only retroactive for people who were convicted between 2013 and 2016. Frankly, I think that's an absurd result. What we have here, again, is a decision that changed the elements the state has to prove. On the face of the charging document, today, Mr. Johnson is not guilty of test refusal.
Is the fact that it changes the elements of the crime sufficient to make it substantive?
Yes, under Shriro it is. But we don't have only changing the elements. We have changing the elements, narrowing the scope of the criminal statute, because in the past, you only needed to have that one single factor exigency. Now you need to have more than one single factor exigency, or now you need a totality of the circumstances exigency analysis. So before it was pretty easy to get a warrant or to justify the search. Now it's a little more difficult to justify the search. So it narrowed the scope of the criminal statute. And finally, it also created a class of people, just like Johnson, who are no longer guilty of test refusal. People who under that single factor exigency, whose convictions are not valid because that's all the state had to prove their guilt, was that, or to prove that the test would have been constitutionally required. Under Johnson, McNeely created a class of people who were no longer guilty. Like I said at the beginning, the core question here to determine whether a rule is substantive or procedural is whether, based on the facts alleged in that complaint, a person is innocent or guilty under today's law. Johnson is innocent and his conviction must be vacated. We ask you to affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Surges. We'll turn back to Mr. Petras.
I want to draw the court's attention to a line that was in the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Johnson. And that line is at pin site or page number 684. And what the Minnesota Supreme Court wrote in Johnson's last appeal is, quote, "The state is correct that the application of the Birchfield rule may require each case to be assessed individually to determine whether a warrant or an exception to the warrant requirement existed at the time of the test refusal," period. Again, that's page number 684. And responding to Ms. Surge's argument that what matters is what's in the complaint, well, that line from Johnson's last appeal would indicate that if we are limited to what is written in the charging document in the complaint, we're also limited to whether that exception existed at the time of the test refusal. And it can't be disputed that under Schreiner and under Netland in 2009, at the time of the test refusal, as well as the time that the complaint was filed in early 2010, a single factor exigency existed for the dissipation of alcohol. I don't think it is absurd for the the retroactivity of Birchfield to be limited only to 2013. In fact, I think the Minnesota Supreme Court specifically contemplated that possibility, which was the reason that they dropped footnote 8 in their Supreme Court decision, as Judge Jessen referenced that footnote earlier. And I understand that Ms. Surges disagrees about the persuasive value of the Sebulka decision. I just want to read one general statement that this court made in Sebulka that wasn't limited to test refusal or wasn't limited specifically to McNeely. And that statement was, we believe that it is more appropriate to determine a new rule's retroactive application based on what the opinion announcing the new rule states, not based on how the new rule is sought to be used by parties in subsequent cases. And what respondent is trying to do is effectively merge two separate rules. And that's not retroactivity law. What matters, as we were talking about earlier, is the function and character of each rule as a constitutional matter, not how any litigant tries to use that rule afterwards. And as a purely constitutional matter, McNeely regulates how exigent circumstances are determined. Birchfield and Trahan and Thompson foreclose an entire exception to the warrant requirement from applying to warrantless blood and warrantless urine testing. In contrast, McNeely did not do that. McNeely did not foreclose any exception. After McNeely, exigent circumstances can still justify a warrantless blood test or a warrantless urine test. The only difference after McNeely is how a court determines if exigent circumstances exist. I see I have a little bit more than a minute left. I am happy to answer any questions the panel has. I'll give a few seconds for that.
So, Mr. Petras, if you could, and I understand you wouldn't agree with this, but if the panel believed that this McNeely was retroactive, could you address the question about whether we should be making a decision or remanding, and if we remanded, what the scope of those remand instructions should look like?
Yeah. If you were to find McNeely retroactive, I think a remand is necessary. Because under that circumstance, the burden of proof in light of Fagan would be on respondent to establish that under the totality of the circumstances, that there was not an exception to the warrant requirement and there was no exigency that would have justified the request for the warrantless test back in 2009. And there is language in McNeely itself that I referenced earlier that talks about, besides just the dissipation of alcohol, what other factors could impact that exigency determination. But I think in light of Fagan, that's what this court would have to do.
That's right on time as far as
your arguments definitely enhanced our ability to understand the issues in this case. Despite our technology issues, we will be taking this under advisement. In fact, we will be speaking about the case, not via WebEx, but actually in a different format after this hearing. We appreciate your patience first and foremost, but a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. Now, with that said, judges, we will adjourn and then I will initiate the renewed communication. Thank you, everyone.